This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Stock Investing for Dummies, second edition by Paul Mladenovic, read by Brett Barry. Copyright 2006 by Wiley Publishing, Inc. Production and abridgment copyright 2007 by HarperCollins Publishers. Although the stock market has served millions of investors for nearly a century, recent years have shown me that a great investing vehicle such as stocks can be easily misunderstood, misused, and even abused. The great bull market of 1982 to 1999 came to a screeching halt in 2000. During 2000 to 2002, millions of investors lost a total of over $5 trillion. What bothers me is that much of that loss was easily avoidable. Investors at the tail end of a bull market often think that stock investing is an easy, carefree, certain way to make a quick fortune. How wrong they are. The countless stories of investors who lost tremendous amounts of money speculating in tech stocks, dot-coms, and other flashy stocks are lessons for all of us. Successful stock investing takes diligent work and knowledge, like any other meaningful pursuit. This audiobook can definitely help you avoid the mistakes others have made and can point you in the right direction. Understanding what not to do can be just as important as figuring out what to do. In all the years that I have counseled and educated investors, the single difference between success and failure, between gain and loss, boils down to one word: knowledge. Take this recording as your first step in a lifelong learning adventure. The stock market has been a cornerstone of the investor's passive wealth-building program for over a century, and continues in this role. The period of 1995 to 2005 was one huge roller coaster ride for stock investors. If it was a stock chart, the graph would look like Mount Everest. Fortunes were made and lost. With just a little more knowledge and a few wealth-preserving techniques, more investors could have held on to their hard-earned stock market fortunes. This audiobook is designed to give you a realistic approach to making money in stocks. It provides the essence of sound, practical stock investing strategies and insights that have been market-tested and proven from nearly 100 years of stock market history. Stock Investing for Dummies, second edition, doesn't assume that stocks are a sure thing and the be-all and end-all of wealth building. At times, I may tell you not to invest in stocks, and I can help you succeed not only in up markets, but also in down markets. Bull markets and bear markets come and go, but the informed investor can keep making money no matter what. To succeed in the world of stock investing, keep in mind these key success factors. Analyze yourself. What do you want to accomplish with your stock investing? What are your investment goals? Know where to get information. The decisions you make about your money and what stocks to invest in require quality information. Understand why you want to invest in stocks. Are you seeking appreciation, capital gains, or income, dividends? Do some research. Look at the company whose stock you're considering to see whether it's a profitable company worthy of your investment dollars. Choosing a winning stock also means that you choose a winning industry. You'll frequently see stock prices of mediocre companies in hot industries rise higher and faster than solid companies in floundering industries. Therefore, choosing the industry is very important. Understand how the world affects your stock. Stocks succeed or fail in large part due to the environment in which they operate. Economics and politics make up that world, so you should know something about them. Understand and identify megatrends. Doing so makes it easier for you to make money. Use investing strategies like the pros do. In other words, how you go about investing can be just as important as what you invest in. Sometimes, what people tell you to do with stocks is not as revealing as what people are actually doing. This is why I like to look at company insiders before I buy or sell that particular stock. Investing in stocks requires balance. Investors sometimes tie up too much money in stocks, putting themselves at risk of losing a significant portion of their wealth if the market plunges. Then again, other investors place little or no money in stocks and therefore miss out on excellent opportunities to grow their wealth. Investors should make stocks a part of their portfolios, but the operative word is part. You should only let stocks take up a portion of your money. A disciplined investor also has money in bank accounts, bonds, and other assets that offer growth or income opportunities. Whether you're already in stocks or you're looking to get into stocks, you need to find out about how much money you can afford to invest in stocks. No matter what you hoped to accomplish with your stock investing plan, the first step a budding investor should take is figuring out how much you own and how much you owe. To do this, prepare and review your personal balance sheet. A balance sheet is simply a list of your assets, your liabilities, and what each item is currently worth, so you can arrive at your net worth. Your net worth is total assets minus total liabilities. I know that these terms sound like accounting mumbo-jumbo, but knowing your net worth is important to your future financial success, so just do it. Your personal balance sheet is really no different from balance sheets that giant companies prepare. The main difference is a few zeros, but you can use my advice to work on changing that. In fact, the more you find out about your own balance sheet, the easier it is to understand the balance sheet of companies in which you're seeking to invest. First, list cash on your balance sheet. See the next step for more on listing your assets. Your goal is to have in reserve at least 3 to 6 months' worth of your gross living expenses in cash. The cash is important because it gives you a cushion. 3 to 6 months is usually enough to get you through the most common forms of financial disruption, such as losing your job. Finding a new job can take anywhere from 3 to 6 months. If your monthly expenses, or outgo, are $2,000, you should have at least $6,000 and probably closer to $12,000 in a secure FDIC-insured interest-bearing bank account or other relatively safe interest-bearing vehicle such as a money market fund. Consider this account an emergency fund and not an investment. Don't use this money to buy stocks. Too many Americans don't have an emergency fund, meaning that they put themselves at risk. Walking across a busy street while wearing a blindfold is a great example of putting yourself at risk, and in recent years, investors have done the financial equivalent. Investors piled on tremendous debt, put too much into investments, such as stocks, that they didn't understand, and had little or no savings. One of the biggest problems during 2000 to 2003 was that savings were sinking to record lows, while debt levels were reaching new heights. People then sold many stocks because they needed funds for, you guessed it, paying bills and debt. Liquid assets aren't references to beer or cola unless you're Anheuser-Busch. Instead, liquidity refers to how quickly you can convert a particular asset, something you own that has value, into cash. If you know the liquidity of your assets, including investments, you have some options when you need cash to buy some stock or pay some bill. All too often, people are short on cash and have too much wealth tied up in illiquid investments, such as real estate. Illiquid is just a fancy way of saying that you don't have the immediate cash to meet a pressing need. Hey, we've all had those moments. Review your assets and take measures to ensure that you have enough liquid assets along with your illiquid assets. Liabilities are simply the bills that you're obligated to pay. Whether it's a credit card bill or a mortgage payment, a liability is an amount of money you have to pay back eventually with interest. If you don't keep track of your liabilities, you may end up thinking that you have more money than you really do. If you can't pay off high interest debt, at least look for ways to minimize the cost of carrying the debt. Your mission, if you choose to accept it, and you should, is to ensure that your net worth increases from year to year as you progress toward your financial goal. Consider stocks as tools for living, just like any other investment. No more, no less. Stocks are the tools you use, one of many, to accomplish something, to achieve a goal. Yes, successfully investing in stocks is the goal that you're probably shooting for if you're listening to this audiobook. However, you must consider stock investing as a means to an end. Know the difference between long-term, intermediate-term, and short-term goals, and then set some of each. Long-term is a reference to projects or financial goals that need funding 5 or more years from now. Intermediate-term refers to financial goals that need funding 2 to 5 years from now, while short-term goals need funding less than 2 years from now. Stocks, in general, are best suited for long-term goals such as these. Achieving financial independence. Think retirement funding. Paying for future college costs. Paying for any long-term expenditure or project. Some categories of stock, such as conservative or blue chip, may be suitable for intermediate-term financial goals. If, for example, you will retire 4 years from now, conservative stocks are appropriate. If you're optimistic about the stock market and confident that stock prices will rise, then go ahead and invest. However, if you're negative about the market, you're bearish, or you believe that stock prices will decline, you may want to wait until the economy starts to forge a clear path. Stocks generally aren't suitable for short-term investing goals because stock prices can behave irrationally in a short period of time. Stocks fluctuate from day to day, so you don't know what the stock will be worth in the near future. You may end up with less money than you expected. For investors seeking to reliably accrue money for short-term needs, short-term bank certificates of deposit or money market funds are more appropriate. In recent years, investors have sought quick, short-term profits by trading and speculating in stocks. Lured by the fantastic returns generated by the stock market in the late 1990s, investors saw stocks as a get-rich-quick scheme. It is very important for you to understand the difference between investing, saving, and speculating. Which one do you want to do? Knowing the answer to this question is crucial to your goals and aspirations. Investors who don't know the difference tend to get burned. Here's some information to help you distinguish among these three actions. Investing is the act of putting your current funds into securities or tangible assets for the purpose of gaining future appreciation, income, or both. You need time, knowledge, and discipline to invest. The investment can fluctuate in price, but has been chosen for long-term potential. Saving is the safe accumulation of funds for a future use. Savings don't fluctuate and are generally free of financial risk. The emphasis is on safety and liquidity. Speculating is the financial world's equivalent of gambling. An investor who speculates is seeking quick profits gained from short-term price movements in that particular asset or investment. These distinctly different concepts are often confused, even among so-called financial experts. I know of one financial advisor who actually put a child's college fund money into an internet stock fund, only to lose over $17,000 in less than 10 months. This advisor thought that she was investing, but in reality, she was speculating. I know of another advisor who told a client to avoid savings accounts altogether because the client had a 401k plan. This particular advisor didn't catch the crucial difference between saving and investing. The client eventually found out the difference. His 401k fell by 40% when the bear market of 2000 arrived. Fortunately, we can learn from these situations and get back on track. That child that lost the $17,000? He's my neighbor, and I helped the father to reinvest the remaining funds. The portfolio doubled in value by the following year and is still growing. The second fellow that lost 40% in his 401k account? He became my student, and he has recouped his losses, and his 401k plan is up. This occurred within 2 years. As of 2005, both investors have portfolios that are beating the general market. Short-term stock investing is very unpredictable. You can better serve your short-term goals with stable, interest-bearing investments, like certificates of deposit at your local bank. During the raging bull market of the late 1990s, investors watched as some high-profile stocks went up 20 to 50% in a matter of months. Hey, who needs a savings account earning a measly interest when stocks grow like that? Of course, when the bear market hit from 2000 to 2003 and those same stocks fell 50 to 85%, a savings account earning a measly interest rate suddenly didn't seem so bad. Stocks, even the best ones, fluctuate in the short term. In a negative environment, they can be very volatile because no one can accurately predict the price movement unless you have some inside information. Stocks are definitely inappropriate for any financial goal that you need to reach within 1 year. Intermediate term refers to your financial goals that you plan to reach within 5 years. If, for example, you want to accumulate funds to put money down for investment in real estate 4 years from now, some growth-oriented investments may be suitable. Although some stocks may be appropriate for a 2 or 3 year period, not all stocks are good intermediate-term investments. Different types and categories of stocks exist. Some stocks are fairly stable and hold their value well, such as the stock of much larger or established dividend-paying companies. Other stocks have prices that jump all over the place, such as the stocks of untested companies that haven't been in existence long enough to develop a consistent track record. If you plan to invest in the stock market to meet intermediate-term goals, consider large, established companies or dividend-paying companies in industries that provide the necessities of life, like food and beverage or electric utilities. Stock investing is best suited for making money over a long period of time. When you measure stocks against other investments in terms of 5 to preferably 10 or more years, they excel. Even investors who bought stocks during the depths of the Great Depression saw profitable growth in their stock portfolios over a 10-year period. In fact, if you examine any 10-year period over the past 50 years, you see that stocks beat out other financial investments, such as bonds or bank investments, in almost every single 10-year period when measured by total return, taking into account reinvesting and compounding of capital gains and dividends. Of course, your work doesn't stop at deciding on a long-term investment. You still have to do your homework and choose stocks wisely, because even in good times, you can lose money if you invest in companies that go out of business. When investors want their money to grow, they look for investments that appreciate in value. Appreciate is just another way of saying grow. If you have a stock that you bought for $8 per share, and now its value is $30 per share, your investment has grown by $22 per share. That's appreciation. I know I would appreciate it. Appreciation, also known as capital gain, is probably the number one reason why people invest in stocks. Few investments have the potential to grow your wealth as conveniently as stocks. Stocks are a great way to grow your wealth, but they're not the only way. Many investors seek alternative ways to make money, but many of these alternative ways are more aggressive and carry significantly more risk. You may have heard about people who made quick fortunes in areas such as commodities, like wheat, pork bellies, or precious metals, options, and other more sophisticated investment vehicles. Keep in mind that you should limit risky investments to only a portion of your portfolio, such as 10% of your investable funds. Experienced investors, however, can go as high as 20%. Not all investors want to take on the risk that comes with making a killing. Hey, no guts, no glory. Some people just want to invest in the stock market as a means of providing a steady income. They don't need stock values to go through the ceiling. Instead, they need stocks that perform well, consistently. If your purpose for investing in stocks is to create income, you need to choose stocks that pay dividends. Dividends are typically paid quarterly to stockholders on record. Don't confuse dividends with interest. Most people are familiar with interest because that's how you grow your money over the years in the bank. The important difference is that interest is paid to creditors, and dividends are paid to owners, meaning shareholders. And if you own stock, you're a shareholder because stocks represent shares in a publicly traded company. When you buy stock, you buy a piece of that company. When you put money in a bank or when you buy bonds, you basically loan your money. You become a creditor, and the bank or bond issuer is the debtor, and as such, it must eventually pay your money back to you with interest. Investing for income means that you have to consider your investment's yield. If you want income from a stock investment, you must compare the yield from that particular stock with alternatives. Dividend-paying stocks do have the ability to increase in value. They may not have the same growth potential as growth stocks, but at the very least, they have a greater potential for a capital gain than bank CDs or bonds. Your investing style isn't a blue jeans versus three-piece suit debate. It refers to your approach to stock investing. Do you want to be conservative or aggressive? Would you rather be the tortoise or the hare? Your investment personality greatly depends on your purpose and the term over which you're planning to invest. Conservative investing means that you put your money in something proven, tried, and true. You invest your money in safe and secure places, such as banks and government-backed securities. Conservative stock investors want to place their money in companies that have exhibited some of the following qualities. Proven performance. You want companies that have shown increasing sales and earnings year after year. You don't demand anything spectacular, just a strong and steady performance. Market size. Companies should be large cap, short for large capitalization. In other words, they should have a market value exceeding $10 billion. Conservative investors surmise that bigger is safer. Market leadership. Companies should be leaders in their industries. Perceived staying power. You want companies with the financial clout and market position to weather uncertain market and economic conditions. It shouldn't matter what happens in the economy or who gets elected. As a conservative investor, you don't mind if the company's share prices jump. Who would? But you're more concerned with steady growth over the long term. Aggressive investors can plan long term or look only over the intermediate term, but in any case, they want stocks that resemble jackrabbits. They show the potential to break out of the pack. Aggressive stock investors want to invest their money in companies that have exhibited some of the following qualities. Great potential. The company must have superior goods, services, ideas, or ways of doing business compared to the competition. Capital gains possibility. You don't even consider dividends. If anything, you dislike dividends. You feel that the money that would have been dispensed in dividend form is better reinvested in the company. This, in turn, can spur greater growth. Innovation. Companies should have technologies, ideas, or innovative methods that make them stand apart from other companies. Aggressive investors usually seek out small capitalization stocks, known as small caps, because they have plenty of potential for growth. The simplest definition of risk for investors is the possibility that your investment will lose some or all of its value. Yet you don't have to fear risk if you understand and plan for it. You need to get familiar with the concept of risk. You must understand the oldest equation in the world of investing, risk versus return. This equation states the following. If you want a greater return on your money, you need to tolerate more risk. If you don't want to tolerate more risk, you must tolerate a lower rate of return. Financial risk is a real concern, even when the economy is doing well. Some diligent research, a little planning, and a dose of common sense help you reduce your financial risk. In the stock investing mania of the late 1990s, millions of investors, along with many well-known investment gurus, ignored some obvious financial risks of many then-popular stocks. Internet and tech stocks littered the graveyard of stock market catastrophes during 2000 to 2001 because investors didn't see, or didn't want to see, the risks involved with companies that didn't offer a solid record of results, profits, sales, and so on. Remember that when you invest in companies that don't have a proven track record, you're not investing, you're speculating. Investors who did their homework regarding the financial conditions of companies such as the internet stocks discovered that these companies had the hallmarks of financial risk: high debt, low or no earnings, and plenty of competition. They steered clear, avoiding tremendous financial loss. Investors who didn't do their homework were lured by the status of these companies, the poster children of booming internet fortunes, and lost their shirts. Of course, the individual investors who lost money by investing in these trendy, high-profile companies don't deserve all the responsibility for their tremendous financial losses. Some high-profile analysts and media sources also should have known better. The late 1990s may someday be a case study of how euphoria and the herd mentality, rather than good old-fashioned research and common sense, ruled the day, temporarily. The excitement of making potential fortunes gets the best of people sometimes, and they throw caution to the wind. Historians may look back at those days and say, what were they thinking? Achieving true wealth takes diligent work and careful analysis. Rising and falling interest rates offer a special risk to stock investors. Historically, rising interest rates have had an adverse effect on stock prices. Now I'll outline several reasons why. Rising interest rates have a negative impact on companies that carry a large current debt load or that need to take on more debt because when interest rates rise, the cost of borrowing money rises too. Ultimately, the company's profitability and ability to grow are reduced. When a company's profits or earnings drop, its stock becomes less desirable, and its stock price falls. A company's success comes when it sells its products or services. But what happens if increased interest rates negatively impact its customers, specifically other companies that buy from it? The financial health of its customers directly affects the company's ability to grow sales and earnings. For a good example of this situation, consider what happened to Cisco Systems in 2000. Because a huge part of its sales went to the telecommunications industry, Cisco's profitability depended on the health of that entire industry. The telecom industry's debt ballooned to $700 billion. This debt became the telecom industry's financial Achilles heel, which in turn became a pain in the neck to Cisco. Because telecom companies bought less, especially from Cisco, Cisco's profits shrank. From March 2000 to March 2001, Cisco's stock fell by nearly 70%. As of September 2001, Cisco's stock price continued to decline because the companies that were Cisco's customers were hurting financially. When interest rates rise, investors start to rethink their investment strategies, resulting in one of two outcomes. Investors may sell any shares in interest-sensitive stocks that they hold. Interest-sensitive industries include electric utilities, real estate, and the financial sector. Although increased interest rates can hurt these sectors, the reverse is also generally true. Falling interest rates boost the same industries. Keep in mind that interest rate changes affect some industries more than others. Investors who favor increased current income versus waiting for the investment to grow in value to sell for a gain later on are definitely attracted to investment vehicles that offer a higher rate of return. Higher interest rates can cause investors to switch from stocks to bonds or bank certificates of deposit. High or rising interest rates can have a negative impact on any investor's total financial picture. What happens when an investor struggles with burdensome debt, such as a second mortgage, credit card debt, or margin debt, debt from borrowing against stock in a brokerage account? He may sell some stock in order to pay off some of his high interest debt. Selling stock to service debt is a common practice that, when taken collectively, can hurt stock prices. The U.S. economy now faces perhaps the greatest challenge since the Great Depression, debt. In terms of gross domestic product, GDP, the size of the economy is about $11.5 trillion, give or take $100 billion. But the debt level is about $37 trillion. This already enormous amount does not include $44 trillion of liabilities, such as Social Security and Medicare. Additionally, yikes, there's more? Some of our financial institutions hold over $50 trillion worth of derivatives. These can be very complicated and sophisticated investment vehicles that can backfire. Derivatives have, in fact, sunk some large organizations, such as Enron, and investors should be aware of them. Just check out the company's financial reports. Because of the effects of interest rates on stock portfolios, both direct and indirect, successful investors regularly monitor interest rates in both the general economy and in their personal situations. Investing requires diligent work and research before putting your money in quality investments with a long-term perspective. Speculating is attempting to make a relatively quick profit by monitoring the short-term price movements of a particular investment. Investors seek to minimize risk, whereas speculators don't mind risk because it can also magnify profits. Speculating and investing have clear differences, but investors frequently become speculators and ultimately put themselves and their wealth at risk. Don't go there. If you don't understand stocks, don't invest. I think that some measure of stock investing is a good idea for most people, but that doesn't mean you should be 100% invested 100% of the time. If you don't understand a particular stock, or don't understand stocks, period, stay away until you do understand. Instead, give yourself an imaginary sum of money, such as $100,000. Give yourself reasons to invest, and just make believe. Pick a few stocks that you think will increase in value, and then track them for a while and see how they perform. Begin to understand how the price of a stock goes up and down, and watch what happens to the stocks you chose when various events take place. As you find out more and more about stock investing, you get better and better at picking individual stocks, and you haven't risked, or lost, any money during your learning period. A good place to do your imaginary investing is at a website such as Marketocracy, www.marketocracy.com. You can design a stock portfolio and track its performance with thousands of other investors to see how well you do. Although most people consider the Dow, NASDAQ, and Standard & Poor's 500 to be the stars of the financial press, you may find other indexes equally important to follow because they cover other significant facets of the market, such as small-cap and mid-cap stocks. You can check out other less sexy indexes that cover specific sectors and industries. If you're investing in an internet stock, you should also check the Internet Stock Index to compare what your stock is doing when measured against the index. You can find indexes that cover industries such as transportation, brokerage firms, retailers, computer companies, and real estate firms. For a comprehensive list of indexes, go to www.djindexes.com, a Dow Jones & Company website. The most reliable and most widely respected indexes are produced not only by Dow Jones, but also Standard & Poor's and the major exchanges, markets themselves, such as the New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, the American Stock Exchange, AMEX, and NASDAQ. There are also indexes issued or provided by smaller exchanges, such as the Philadelphia Exchange. Serious investors look at the following indexes. Broad-based indexes. Indexes such as the S&P 500 and the Wilshire 5000 are more realistic gauges of the stock market's performance than the Dow. Industry or sector indexes. These indexes are better gauges of the growth or lack of growth of specific industries and sectors. If you buy a gold stock, then you should track the index for the precious metals industry. Dow Jones has several averages, including the Dow Jones Transportation Average, DJTA, and the Dow Jones Utilities Average, DJUA. Dow Jones manages both of these indexes more strictly than the Dow. The DJUA sticks to utilities, so it tends to be a more accurate barometer of the market it represents. The same goes for the DJTA. NASDAQ became a formalized market in 1971. The name used to stand for National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quote System, but now it's simply NASDAQ, as if it's a name, like Ralph or Eddie. NASDAQ indexes are similar to other indexes in style and structure. The only difference is that, well, they cover companies traded on the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ has two indexes, both reported in the financial pages. NASDAQ Composite Index. Most frequently quoted on the news, the NASDAQ Composite Index covers the more than 5,000 companies that trade on NASDAQ. The companies encompass a variety of industries, but the index's concentration has primarily been technology, telecom, and internet industries. The NASDAQ Composite Index hit an all-time high of 5,048 in March 2000 before the worst bear market in its history occurred. The index dropped a whopping 60% by 2003 to approximately 2,000. NASDAQ 100 Index. The NASDAQ 100 tracks the 100 largest companies in NASDAQ. This index is for investors who want to concentrate on the largest companies, which tend to be especially weighted in technology issues, which means it provides extra representation of technology-related companies, such as Microsoft, Adobe, and Symantec. In either case, although these indexes track growth-oriented companies, the stocks of these companies are also very volatile and carry commensurate risk. The indexes themselves bear this risk out. In the bear market of 2000 and 2001, and even extending into 2002, they fell more than 60%. The Standard & Poor's 500, S&P 500, tracks the 500 largest, measured by market value, publicly traded companies. The publishing firm Standard & Poor's created this index. I bet you could have guessed that. Because it contains 500 companies, the S&P 500 represents overall market performance better than the DJIA's 30 companies. Money managers and financial advisors actually watch the S&P 500 stock index more closely than the DJIA. Most mutual funds especially like to measure their performance against the S&P 500, rather than against any other index. Mutual funds that concentrate on small-cap stocks usually prefer an index that has more small-cap stocks in it, such as the Russell 2000. The S&P 500 doesn't attempt to cover the 500 biggest companies. Instead, it includes companies that are widely held and widely followed. The companies are also industry leaders in a variety of industries, including energy, technology, healthcare, and finance. Although it's a reliable indicator of the market's overall status, the S&P 500 also has some limitations. Despite the fact that it tracks 500 companies, the top 50 companies encompass 50% of the index's market value. This situation can be a drawback because those 50 companies have a greater influence on the S&P 500 index's price movement than any other segment of companies. In other words, 10% of the companies have an equal impact to 90% of the companies on the same index. Therefore, although the index better represents the market than the DJIA, the index may not offer an accurate representation of the general market. The Russell 3000 Index is a great example of an index that seeks more comprehensive inclusion of U.S. companies. It includes the 3,000 largest publicly traded companies, nearly 98% of publicly traded stocks. The Russell 3000 is important because it includes many mid-cap and small-cap stocks. Most companies covered in the Russell 3000 have an average market value of $1 billion or less. The Frank Russell Company created the Russell 3000 Index and actually computes a series of indexes, such as the Russell 1000 and the Russell 2000. The Russell 2000, for example, contains the smallest 2,000 companies from the Russell 3000, while the Russell 1000 contains the largest 1,000 companies. The Russell indexes don't cover microcap stocks, companies with a market capitalization under $250 million. The Wilshire 5000 Equity Index, often referred to as the Wilshire Total Market Index, is probably the largest stock index in the world. Wilshire Associates started out in 1980, tracking 5,000 stocks. Since then, the Wilshire 5000 has ballooned to cover more than 7,500 stocks. The advantage of the Wilshire 5000 is that it's very comprehensive, covering nearly the entire market. For investors and analysts that seek the greatest representation, performance of the general market, they would check out this index. At the very least, the Wilshire 5000 tracks the largest publicly traded stocks. It includes all the stocks that are on the major stock exchanges, NYSE, Amex, and the largest issues on NASDAQ, which by default also include all the stocks covered by the S&P 500. Before you invest in stocks, you need to be completely familiar with the basics of stock investing. At its most fundamental, stock investing is about using your money to buy a piece of a company that will give you value in the form of appreciation or income. Fortunately, many resources are available to help you find out about stock investing. Some of my favorite places are the stock exchanges themselves. Stock exchanges are organized marketplaces for the buying and selling of stocks and other securities. The New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, the premier stock exchange, provides a framework for stock buyers and sellers to make their transactions. The NYSE makes money not only from a piece of every transaction, but also from fees, such as listing fees, charged to companies and brokers that are members of its exchanges. The main exchanges for most stock investors are the NYSE and the American Stock Exchange, AMEX. NASDAQ is technically not an exchange, but it is a formal market that effectively acts as an exchange. These three encourage and inform people about stock investing. Because these exchanges, markets, benefit from increased popularity of stock investing and continued demand for stocks, they offer a wealth of free or low-cost information and resources for stock investors. Go to their websites and you find useful resources such as tutorials on how to invest in stocks, common investment strategies, and so on. Glossaries and free information to help you understand the language, practice, and purpose of stock investing. A wealth of news, press releases, financial data, and other information about companies listed at the exchange or market, accessed usually through an on-site search engine. Industry analysis and news. Stock quotes and other market information related to the daily market movements of stocks, including data such as volume, new highs, new lows, and so on. Free tracking of your stock selections. You can input a sample portfolio or the stocks you are following to see how well you're doing. What each exchange market offers keeps changing or is updated, so go explore each at their websites. New York Stock Exchange, www.nyse.com. American Stock Exchange, www.amex.com. NASDAQ, www.nasdaq.com. Before you invest, you need to know what's going on with the company. When you read about a company, either from the company's literature, its annual report, for example, or from media sources, be sure to get answers to some pertinent questions. Is the company making more net income than it did last year? You want to invest in a company that is growing. Are the company's sales greater than they were the year before? Remember, you won't make money if the company isn't making money. Is the company issuing press releases on new products, services, inventions, or business deals? All these achievements indicate a strong, vital company. Knowing how the company is doing, no matter what's happening with the general economy, is obviously important. As you consider investing in a stock, make it a point to know what's going on in that company's industry. If the industry is doing well, your stock is likely to do well too. But then again, the reverse is also true. Yes, I have seen investors pick successful stocks in a failing industry, but those cases are exceptional. By and large, it's easier to succeed with a stock when the entire industry is doing well. As you're watching the news, reading the financial pages, or viewing financial websites, check out the industry to see that it's strong and dynamic. No matter how well or how poorly the overall economy is performing, you want to stay informed about its general progress. It's easier for the value of stock to keep going up when the economy is stable or growing. The reverse is also true. If the economy is contracting or declining, the stock has a tougher time keeping its value. Some basic items to keep tabs on include the following. Gross domestic product, GDP. This is roughly the total value of output for a particular nation, measured in the dollar amount of goods and services. GDP is reported quarterly, and a rising GDP bodes well for your stock. When the GDP is rising 3% or more on an annual basis, that's solid growth. If it rises at more than zero but less than 3%, that's generally considered less than stellar or mediocre. GDP under zero or negative means that the economy is shrinking, heading into recession. The Index of Leading Economic Indicators, LEI. The LEI is a snapshot of a set of economic statistics covering activity that precedes what's happening in the economy. Each statistic helps you understand the economy in much the same way that barometers and windows help you understand what's happening with the weather. Economists don't just look at an individual statistic. They look at a set of statistics to get a more complete picture of what's happening with the economy. Keep your eyes open to emerging trends in society at large. What trends are evident now? Can you anticipate the wants and needs of tomorrow's society? Being alert, staying a step ahead of the public, and choosing stock appropriately gives you a profitable edge over other investors. If you own stock in a solid company with growing sales and earnings, other investors eventually notice. As more investors buy up your company's stocks, you're rewarded as the stock price increases. Good investment selection means looking at several sources before you decide on a stock. No shortcut exists. That said, getting opinions from others never hurts. Just be sure to carefully analyze the information you get. Now I present some important points to bear in mind as you evaluate tips and advice from others. Consider the source. Frequently, people buy stock based on the views of some market strategist or market analyst. People may see an analyst being interviewed on a television financial show and take that person's opinions and advice as valid and good. The danger here is that the analyst may be biased because of some relationship that isn't disclosed on the show. It happens on TV all too often. The show's host interviews analyst You Are Kidding Me from the investment firm Fulham & Sellum. The analyst says, Implosion Corp is a good buy with solid long-term upside potential. You later find out that the analyst's employer gets investment banking fees from Implosion Corp. Do you really think that analyst would ever issue a negative report on a company that's helping to pay the bills? It's not likely. Get multiple views. Don't base your investment decisions on just one source, unless you have the best reasons in the world for thinking that a particular single source is outstanding and reliable. A better approach is to scour current issues of independent financial publications, such as Barron's, Money Magazine, and Smart Money. Gather data from the SEC. When you want to get more objective information about a company, why not take a look at the reports that companies must file with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC? These reports are the same reports that the pundits and financial reporters read. Arguably, the most valuable report you can look at is the 10-K. The 10-K is a report that all publicly traded companies must file with the SEC. It provides valuable information on the company's operations and financial data, and is likely to be less biased than the information a company includes in other corporate reports, such as an annual report. To access 10-K reports, go to the SEC's website, www.sec.gov. From there, you can find the SEC's extensive database of public filings, called EDGAR, Electronic Data Gathering, Analysis, and Retrieval System. By searching EDGAR, you can find companies' balance sheets, income statements, and other related information, so that you can verify what others say and get a fuller picture of what a company is doing and what its financial condition is. When you're ready to dive in and start investing in stocks, you first have to choose a broker. It's kind of like buying a car. You can do all the research in the world and know exactly what kind of car you want to buy. Still, you need a venue to do the actual transaction. Similarly, when you want to buy stock, your task is to do all the research you can to select the company you want to invest in. Still, you need a broker to actually buy the stock, whether you buy over the phone or online. The broker's primary role is to serve as the vehicle through which you either buy or sell stock. When I talk about brokers, I'm referring to organizations such as Charles Schwab, Merrill Lynch, E-Trade, and many other organizations that can buy stock on your behalf. Brokers can also be individuals who work for such firms. Although you can buy some stocks directly from the company that issues them, to purchase most stocks, you still need a broker. Although the primary task of brokers is the buying and selling of securities, such as stocks, keep in mind that the word securities refers to the world of financial or paper investments, and that stocks are only a small part of that world, they can perform other tasks for you, including the following. providing advisory services. Investors pay brokers a fee for investment advice. Customers also get access to the firm's research. Offering limited banking services. Brokers can offer features such as interest-bearing accounts, check writing, direct deposit, and credit cards. Brokering other securities. Brokers can also buy bonds, mutual funds, options, exchange-traded funds, ETFs, and other investments on your behalf. Personal stockbrokers make their money from individual investors, like you and me, through various fees, including the following. Brokerage commissions. This fee is for buying and or selling stocks and other securities. Margin interest charges. This interest is charged to investors for borrowing against their brokerage account for investment purposes. Service charges. These charges are for performing administrative tasks and other functions. Brokers charge fees to investors for individual retirement accounts, IRAs, and for mailing stocks in certificate form. Any broker you deal with should be registered with the National Association of Securities Dealers, NASD, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. In addition, to protect your money after you've deposited it into a brokerage account, that broker should be a member of the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, SIPC. SIPC doesn't protect you from market losses. It protects your money in case the brokerage firm goes out of business. To find out whether the broker is registered with these organizations, contact the NASD, SEC, and SIPC. The distinction between personal stockbrokers and institutional stockbrokers is important. Institutional brokers make money from institutions and companies through investment banking and securities placement fees, such as initial public offerings and secondary offerings, advisory services, and other broker services. Personal stockbrokers generally offer the same services to individuals and small businesses. Stockbrokers fall into two basic categories: full service and discount. The type you choose really depends on what type of investor you are. In a nutshell, full service brokers are suitable for investors who need some guidance, while discount brokers are better for those investors who are sufficiently confident and knowledgeable about stock investing to manage with minimal help. Full service brokers are just what the name indicates. They try to provide as many services as possible for investors who open accounts with them. When you open an account at a brokerage firm, a representative is assigned to your account. This representative is usually called an account executive, a registered rep, or a financial consultant by the brokerage firm. This person usually has a securities license and is knowledgeable about stocks in particular and investing in general. Your account executive is responsible for assisting you, answering questions about your account and the securities in your portfolio, and transacting your buy and sell orders. Here are some things that full-service brokers can do for you. Offer guidance and advice. The greatest distinction between full-service brokers and discount brokers is the personal attention you receive from your account rep. You get to be on a first-name basis with a full-service broker, and you disclose much information about your finances and financial goals. The rep is there to make recommendations about stocks and funds that are hopefully suitable for you. Provide access to research. Full-service brokers can give you access to their investment research department, which can give you in-depth information and analysis on a particular company. This information can be very valuable, but be aware of the pitfalls. Help you achieve your investment objectives. Beyond advice on specific investments, a good rep gets to know you and your investment goals, and then offers advice and answers your questions about how specific investments and strategies can help you accomplish your wealth-building goals. Make investment decisions on your behalf. Many investors don't want to be bothered when it comes to investment decisions. Full-service brokers can actually make decisions for your account with your authorization. This service is fine, but be sure to require them to explain their choices to you. Although the full-service brokers, with their seemingly limitless assistance, can make life easy for an investor, you need to remember some important points to avoid problems. Brokers and account reps are still salespeople. No matter how well they treat you, they're still compensated based on their ability to produce revenue for the brokerage firm. They generate commissions and fees from you on behalf of the company. In other words, they're paid to sell you things. Whenever your rep makes a suggestion or recommendation, be sure to ask why and request a complete answer that includes the reasoning behind the recommendation. A good advisor is able to clearly explain the reasoning behind every suggestion. If you don't fully understand and agree with the advice, don't take it. Working with a full-service broker costs more than working with a discount broker. Discount brokers are paid simply for performing the act of buying or selling stocks for you. Full-service brokers do that and more. Additionally, they provide advice and guidance. Because of that, full-service brokers are more expensive through higher brokerage commissions and advisory fees. Also, most full-service brokers expect you to invest at least $5,000 to $10,000 just to open an account. Handing over decision-making authority to your rep can be a possible negative because letting others make financial decisions for you is always dicey, especially when they're using your money. If they make poor investment choices that lose you money, you may not have any recourse because you authorize them to act on your behalf. Some brokers engage in an activity called churning. Churning is basically buying and selling stocks for the sole purpose of generating commissions. Churning is great for brokers, but bad for customers. If your account shows a lot of activity, ask for justification. Commissions, especially by full-service brokers, can take a big bite out of your wealth, so don't tolerate churning or other suspicious activity. Before you deal with any broker, full service or otherwise, get a free report on the broker from the National Association of Securities Dealers by calling 800-289-9999 or visiting the NASD regulation website at www.nasdr.com. The report can indicate whether any complaints or penalties have been filed against that brokerage firm or the individual rep. Examples of full-service brokers are Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley. Of course, all brokers now have full-featured websites to give you further information about their services. Get as informed as possible before you open your account. A full-service broker is there to help you build wealth, not make you, broker. Perhaps you don't need any hand-holding from a broker. You know what you want, and you can make your own investment decisions. All you want is someone to transact your buy-sell orders. In that case, go with a discount broker. They don't offer advice or premium services, just the basics required to perform your stock transactions. Discount brokers, as the name implies, are cheaper to engage than full-service brokers. Because you're advising yourself or getting advice from third parties, such as newsletters or independent advisors, you can save on costs that you incur when you pay for a full-service broker. If you choose to work with a discount broker, you must know as much as possible about your personal goals and needs. You have a greater responsibility for conducting adequate research to make good stock selections, and you must be prepared to accept the outcome, whatever that may be. For a while, the regular investor had two types of discount brokers to choose from: conventional discount brokers and internet discount brokers. But the two are so similar now that the differences are hardly worth mentioning. Conventional discount brokers primarily conducted business through regular offices and over the phone, while internet discount brokers conducted business primarily through websites. But through industry consolidation, most of the conventional discount brokers today have fully featured websites, while internet discount brokers adapted by adding more telephone and face-to-face services. Charles Schwab and TD Waterhouse are examples of conventional discount brokers that have adapted well to the internet era. Internet brokers such as eTrade.com, Ameritrade.com, ScottTrade.com, and ThinkOrSwim.com have added more conventional services. Discount brokers offer some significant advantages over full-service brokers, such as lower cost. This lower cost is usually the result of lower commissions, and it's the primary benefit of using discount brokers. Unbiased service. Discount brokers offer you the ability to just transact your stock, buy, and sell orders only. Since they don't offer advice, they have no vested interest in trying to sell you any particular stock. Access to information. Established discount brokers offer extensive educational materials at their offices or on their websites. Of course, doing business with discount brokers also has its downside, including the following. No guidance. Because you've chosen a discount broker, you know not to expect guidance, but the broker should make this fact clear to you anyway. If you're a knowledgeable investor, the lack of advice is considered a positive thing.